All right, we've been talking about the existence of God. Now we've done it. We talked about the cosmological argument last week, and I chose a version of the cosmological argument last week. I did not present the argument in general. I presented the argument in a specific way. I called it the usually argument. It is more accurately called the contingency argument. Now tonight we're dealing with a second argument for the existence of God, and this argument goes way, way back. It is found in all Abrahamic religions, which includes, of course, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. And so it has had its proponents throughout the history of these religions. The teleological argument has faced objections. The objections began to really pour in what we would call the empirical movement, the time of what we think of as the Renaissance. During that time of expansion and the growth of knowledge, it was the teleological argument that was the support of Immanuel Kant and René Descartes. In fact, if you read either of their great treatises, you will read the teleological argument. But in modern history, the Scottish philosopher David Hume brought what many believe to be the conquest of the teleological argument. We're on introduction right now. We're just kind of introducing it. I'm going to give you the teleological argument in a moment, but I want you to know that this has been around a long time, and it went silent for almost 200 years. And in the middle of the last century, it began to experience a revival, if you would. And it was, in this case, with scientific discovery. And the teleological argument that had faced what looked like the death blow from David Hume was resuscitated. And it is revived and renewed. And it faces a new future. And so tonight, I'm not going to be presenting the teleological argument from ancient history. I'm going to be presenting the teleological argument in a very narrow perspective. Let me give you the teleological argument. It's written there on your outline, but let me just state it for you. There are two statements and then a conclusion. If either one of these two statements is false, then the conclusion will be false. If any part of a statement is false, what about the statement? It's all false. The same is true of a philosophical argument. So here are the statements. That something is designed implies a designer. Let's talk about that for a minute. Suppose you were walking through the woods, hunting deer or something, and you're looking for deer tracks and deer sign, and you come upon a stopwatch. Now, you would likely draw some conclusion about that stopwatch. You would be, out of curiosity, wondering, How did it get here? What you are not likely to conclude is that random materials in the universe converged coincidentally, came together, and formed a precise functioning stopwatch, especially if you were to pick that stopwatch off the ground and open its back and look and see how it was put together. You would see an intricately designed piece of hardware, a machine. Without even picking it up, you would most likely draw the conclusion that this stopwatch was dropped by somebody who needed it or wanted it, used it, and that they got it from someone who made it or designed it. At least you could follow it back. Another example. Do you know what a mouse trap is? I'm not talking about the mouse hotels. I'm talking about the old snap kind of mouse trap. Do you remember those? Very simple devices, aren't they? But do you know every single item in that mouse trap is essential? It's not accidental. Every bit of it. You take any single piece out of that mouse trap, and it's no longer a mousetrap, it's just a contraption. It doesn't do anything, it doesn't function. Now keep those two stories or pictures in your mind as we talk about the teleological argument. That something is designed implies a designer. Doesn't matter what it is. If it's designed, it implies a designer. We were in Salina, Texas, which, if you have any history in Texas, you know 20 years ago was way out in the country. 10 years ago, it was way out in the country. I'm going to say 5 years ago, it was in the country. And I say that because there's evidence that this used to be the country. There are farms everywhere. Even in the middle of the highway, kid you not, in the what we used to call the Esplanade, in the middle of the highway, there are cornfields. Now, how did those cornfields get there? Do you think as the road crews were building the roads, do you think that they just happened to stir up the cosmic dust on the ground and all of the corn that had been absorbed in what do you call that when something dries up and it evaporates? Think it evaporated corn seeds and then dropped those corn seeds in the middle of that highway and they just happened to stir it up and lo and behold, it grew up into corn in perfectly lined up rows. Do you think that happened? Nobody would think that. Some farmer spent money and time and planted that corn, right? Because anytime you see something that is designed without thinking about it, you draw the conclusion there is a designer responsible for that design. This is the teleological argument. Let's move to the second statement. The universe is designed. Now this is what we're going to talk about tonight, and as we talk about it, I hope that we can build the case that there's good reason to believe that the universe is designed. And if both of these first two statements are true, then the conclusion follows. Therefore, the universe implies a designer. Now, let me say something. It doesn't matter what you choose within this universe. I'm choosing the whole universe. But you can use anything within the universe that has design, like you. Like your eye. Either one of them, or both of them. Your eye. If you can show design, there is a designer implied in that design. Now, this argument does not, nor is it intended, to prove the existence of God. We said this in week one. You can't prove the existence of God. That's not what we're out to do. What we're out to do is ask the question, is it reasonable to conclude that God exists? Is it reasonable? Now, not only will we not prove that God exists through the teleological argument, we won't prove that the theistic God exists. We won't prove any God exists. We are not after that. We are after, what does it say? A designer. Now, you might say, well, this is a weak argument. And agreed, it is a weak argument. But it's not intended to be used alone. As Immanuel Kant said in his Five Reasons, this is a cumulative argument. And the weight of the argument is not considered until all of the argument for the existence of God is heard. Last week we used the cosmological argument. And it goes like this. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause. We didn't say who the cause was or what the cause was. We just stated there's a cause. Now tonight we're not going to say who the designer is, just that there is a designer. And I am going to use what is called the fine-tuning argument. The fine-tuning argument of the teleological argument. Now, the word teleos is a Greek word, and it means end or purpose. And together it means the study of purpose or the reason for something. So, I wouldn't put too much stock in that. I don't even like the term teleological. I do like the term the case from design. That's why I put it in parentheses behind it, the case from design. So the fine-tuning argument is a branch or a brand, you might even say, of the teleological argument. And it comes from the field of cosmology, that is the study of the universe in the broadest sense. Cosmology asks such questions as, how did the universe come into being? What is the universe made of? Is the universe finite or infinite in size? What governs the physical laws and constants of the universe? Answers to those questions are the things that occupy the minds of cosmologists. Not every cosmologist is a believer. But it is interesting how many cosmologists use the same language as believers. Let's talk about fine-tuning. Like I said, from the Enlightenment forward, faith and science have kind of been at odds. And that is regarding almost every subject, whether it's the question of origin or the view of the natural world, whether it's faith or science. Many times these have been considered opposing points of view. But hopefully tonight, in our approach to this, we'll discover that science and faith ought not be at odds. Through science, we may be directed toward answers to not only the physical world, but the metaphysical world as well. Most of you are familiar with computers, are you not? I mean, there's more technology available in this device than in the first Mercury spaceship. It's amazing. We're very familiar with this device. But because we've become familiar with it, its language has almost become second language to us. This little thing, it does amazing things. Before the advent of self-checkout at a restaurant where it automatically gives you the 10, 15, 20, and 25% tip amount, I often referred to this device to figure the tip. I could punch in the numbers and I could hit equals and it would tell me how much the tip should be. Let me simplify it. I can push on the calculator of this device 2 plus 2, and I can hit equal, and it will say 4. Now, how in the world does this device know how to do math? How? Did a bunch of pieces come together, form this, and just happens to be able to do math? No, we know better than that. We know that this is a computer. And this computer contains code, language. And these codes are what control the functionality of this device. Same is true of a laptop, same is true, well, for just about everything now. My tractor, for heaven's sakes, has a computer. Your car. Your watch. Not yours. I mean, your watch could tell you things you probably don't want to know about yourself. But it doesn't do it because randomly chosen objects just happen to come together and formulate some. No, they were designed by a designer. A code was written into them that instructs them how to function. In the universe, there is a code. It exists in the universe. The design and the composition of this universe attests to a designer. An intelligence outside the universe that dictated how the universe would function. In fact, second point, many people in the scientific community speak of the universe as being fine-tuned. In other words, they understand that there is a universal code written into this universe that allows it to function as such. Whether you're talking about the macro world of planets and stars and galaxies, or whether you're talking about the micro world of atoms and quantum particles, life in this universe within specific constraints can only exist because of the code that exists in this universe. And the question is raised, why? Why is there such code in this universe? And that brings us to number three, the explanations. There are three possible explanations for the order of the universe, or the codes, if you would, that are written into this universe. One is necessary. It's necessary. Now, you remember, we talked about necessary beings last week. And a necessary being is a being that exists without a cause, without a subject. So the argument is that the universe itself is necessary. It just must be. Well, no cosmologist believes that, because examples can be created of a universe that does not have this code. It's not necessary. At least in theory, it's not necessary. It doesn't just have to be. The second option, beyond being necessary, is chance. Random chance. And we're going to talk about these, especially this matter of chance, because this is really the only place the cosmologist who denies the existence of God can sit. This universe is nothing more, nothing less than the makeup or the constituency of random chance. Maybe over millions and billions of years and millions and billions of interactions, somehow chance is the cause of this designed universe. And the third possibility is a designer. A designer. Now, I've already said that the probability of a universe being able to support life is really improbable. So when scientists talk about our cosmos, they explain it as being finely tuned. That is, it has all of the necessary ingredients for there to be life in this universe. Now think about this for a moment. Suppose you were to sit down and be dealt five cards out of a deck of cards, randomly. And you turn those cards over, it's not a draw game, you just get what you get. That's your game. And you turn over those five cards and you have a royal flush. Now that's a 10, jack, a queen, a king, is that, and an ace, right? All in the same suit. You'd consider yourself lucky, wouldn't you? You'd consider that very lucky. In fact, the odds of drawing a royal flush are exactly 649,740 to 1. If you wrote that digitally, it would be 00153. Now just imagine if you're sitting at a table. You sit down, it's your first draw, and you turn over a royal flush. What are the people at the table going to say? You are the luckiest person on the earth. Now, let's just suppose that the next four hands are all dealt to you, and they all end up being a royal flush. Do you know the odds are exactly the same each time? But what would people say about you now? They would say you cheated. That doesn't happen by chance. Or suppose you are taking a journey across Europe, and you're just backpacking your way across Europe like all people my age wanted to do when we were in our late teens and early 20s. And you're caught having crossed a border that you didn't know you were crossing. You're put in bondage. You're put in a cell. You can't understand anything anybody's saying. And one moment you're taken up, taken outside, and you see 100 riflemen standing there. And you're standing in front of them. And a commander says, "Ready!" And they arm and they shoulder their weapons. Aim! And all the barrels of those rifles line up right at your heart. Fire! And the thunderous sound of 100 rifles go off. And you hear it. And then you smell the smell of gunpowder. But you haven't been hit by anyone. What do you conclude happened? Would you conclude that 100 trained riflemen could not hit you at 10 yards? You would conclude that something was up. And the reason you would know that something is up is because you are there to observe it. Not randomly missing you out of 100 rifle shots. It has been estimated that the chances of life arising in the universe from non-living matter are 1 in 10 to the 40th power. That's a 1 followed by 40 zeros. Consider the following. The chance of a person being struck by lightning is 1 in 10 to the 5th power. That's, by the way, that's the same probability of having quadruplets. The current national debt is $32 trillion. You would write that by writing 32 times 10 to the 12th power. The numbers of grains of sand on the earth is estimated to be 7.5 times 10 to the 18th power. A single grain of sand. A single grain of sand is around 3 × 10^20. And so we're talking about big numbers here. We learn from them that chances of life forming are very, very unlikely. That life forming and intelligence in that life forming is astronomically unlikely, but not impossible. Not likely, but not impossible. Psalm 19, verse 1 says, "The heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of His hands. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and their utterances to the end of the world." What is the psalmist saying? He's saying that in this universe, there is evidence for the existence of God. It's exactly what Paul says in Romans chapter 1, verses 19 through 21. That's called general revelation. Have you ever stood outside, away from the city at night, looked into the sky? And the longer you look, the more you see. At first, you just see the really brilliant lights. Sometimes they're planets. Most times they're stars. But as you gaze, you discover that those individual stars are not alone. The night begins to come into focus and you start to see the evidence of our galaxy. Behind those brilliant stars, or what appears to be behind them, are little finer dots everywhere you look. In 2004, the Hubble telescope focused on what was believed to be a black hole, a dark void spot in our galaxy. But as it focused there in its continuous orbit, do you know what it found in that black hole? Which wasn't a black hole at all. It was just a gap in our galaxy. It discovered 10,000 new galaxies. Not stars, galaxies. Billions of stars in each one of those galaxies. Now, that's one end of the spectrum. All I'm talking about is magnitude here. We see the magnitude of order in the universe, but we see the magnitude of order more closely. Atoms, A-T-O-M, atoms. A basic building block of any matter. But these atoms contain even smaller particles that exist on what is known as the quantum level. Those particles, those smaller particles within the atom, called quantum science, speak as much of a designer as does the entire universe. If you thought about the universe or the atom, think of it like a baker making a cake. There's a recipe. When that recipe is followed, all of the elements go into that mix. Together, they make a cake. But any one of those elements not being present, or being present too much, or too little, or too late, or too early. Are you following me, you bakers? The outcome is not the same, is it? Now imagine that regarding the universe. There are two things that exist in our universe that are like these ingredients. They are called fundamental laws and physical constants. Fundamental laws and physical constants. Let me explain a fundamental law and a physical constant. A fundamental law is like the law of gravity. Now, the older I get, the less I'm pleased with the law of gravity. But I'm still glad it's here. I'm still glad for the law of gravity. But if the law of gravity were not the law of gravity, and it was just whatever, life couldn't exist, folks. Life couldn't exist. Matter could not exist. This universe could not exist. That is a fundamental law. The speed of light is a fundamental law. 186,000 miles per second. Do you know how far the sun is away from us? It is 4.5 light years away. That means if you took 186,000 miles per second and multiplied it so that it equaled 4.5 years. That's how distant the sun is from the earth. And if the speed of light traveled any different, this planet could not sustain life. Never could have, and would not now. Dr. Hugh Ross wrote a book entitled The Improbable Planet. I recommend it. I'm also going to recommend a website, a YouTube website. You might like YouTube videos. And if this doesn't bore you enough, you'll enjoy this YouTube video website. It's called A Fortunate Universe. A Fortunate Universe by Geraint Lewis and Luke Barnes. A Fortunate Universe. Just go into YouTube and type in, search, A Fortunate Universe. They'll come up there. Cosmologists. Let's talk about the fine-tuning of the universe a little bit more. This cosmological constant. That is, a force related to the expansion of the universe. It is associated with what is called dark energy. Now, dark energy is one of those things that really can't be defined. But we know it's there. We know it exists. There is a force, this dark energy, that maintains a sensitive balance equivalent to this ratio, 1 to 10 in the 37th power. That's a 1 followed by 37 zeros. All matter holds together on this universal constant. Now, what is 10 to the 37th power? Take the continent, not just America, but take the North American continent and cover that continent with dimes that extend 239,000 miles. Did you hear me? Now, make a billion continents like ours and put those same number of dimes on those continents, and now you have 10 to the 37th power. That's how many dimes there are. Now, I'm going to blindfold you, and I've hidden a painted dime in all those dimes. You have one opportunity, one chance to pick from all those dimes that painted dime. If you don't pick that painted dime, we all die. Good luck. That's part of the reason that that website is called A Fortunate Universe. The gravitational constant, if it varied, by 1 in 10 to the 60th power. That's nearly twice what I just described as the dark energy. 1 in the 60th, or 10 to the 60th power, the universe would have expanded so rapidly that the stars would not have formed, and therefore, no life and no planet could exist. If they had gone any slower, the universe itself would collapse upon itself. In any case, no life could exist. If the mass and energy of the early universe had not been so perfectly, evenly distributed to a precision of one, are you ready? 1 to the 10th to the 1,230th power, the universe would be so hostile that nothing could exist in it. Now let's get back down to the small. Nuclear force. The force that holds an atom together. If this force were slightly stronger, just slightly stronger, then hydrogen atoms would not survive. And if hydrogen atoms did not survive, there would be no heavier elements ever made. If the nuclear force was slightly smaller, and I'm talking about imperceptibly small, weaker, then the hydrogen atoms could never form, and again, the heavier elements needed for life could never form. Outside of an atom, outside the nucleus of the atom, are electrons. The type of atom that it is determines how many electrons there are. When one atom combines with another atom, it forms a molecule. The positive charges of the protons in the nucleus of that atom and the negative charges of the electrons in that atom hold the atoms together. The mass of the proton, if it is just less than 2,000 times larger than the mass of the electron, under a nuclear microscope, it's enormous, but under a normal microscope, they're even imperceptible. They're tiny. They can't be seen. But the proton itself is 2,000 times larger than the electron. And if that ratio changed in any way, not just slightly, but in any way, stability to bond would be gone. Nothing could exist. That's not all. Electromagnetic force and its ratio to the gravitational force is a balance that must be maintained. It must exist. The number of protons, the number of electrons, the amount of entropy, that is the aging and declining of the universe, the energy being spent in the universe, the speed of light, the average distance between one galaxy and another galaxy, one star and another star, the density of galaxy clusters, the decay rates of protons, the ratio between the mass of a neutron and the mass of a proton. Any of these things differ at all, life cannot exist. In our own solar system, the Earth rotates around the sun at a unique distance called the Goldilocks zone. Not too far, not too close. It allows the temperature range on this earth to be such that it accommodates human habitation. The earth's rotation, any slower, any faster, can't sustain life. The axis tilt of 23 degrees on our planet varies by a micro portion of a degree, and we can't exist. The oxygen level, seismic activity, all of those things are designed for life on this planet. Do you know if the Earth rotated around the sun or rotated around its axis longer than 24 hours in a duration? I'm talking about like 24 hours and 15 minutes. The difference between night and day would be too great. Shorter in duration. And the atmospheric winds caused by the rotation would be such that life couldn't exist on this earth. So, let me come back to the explanation that atheist cosmologists use. Chance. Chance. And none other than Richard Dawkins, in his book, The God Delusion, recognizes that chance is so improbable as a causing agent that he proffers multiple universes. There must be multiple universes, an infinite number of universes. So somewhere there is a universe creating machine that's just spitting out universes. And because it is eternal, it's infinite in its past, it has spit out so many universes that, lo and behold, 5 royal flushes in a row. Dr. William Lane Craig, I've referred to already. He is asked about Richard Dawkins' observation, and he responds. Can you go ahead and pull that up? I want you to hear this, and we'll be closed after this. I'll click it.